The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. And I think it's a little bit loud. Let's see. Is that a little bit? Is that better? A little bit? How's that sound out there for you guys? Good out there? Okay. So we have this new mic that we're still learning a little bit about. So, so about a year and a half ago, there was a meeting that happens every 3 years of the Insight meditation teachers in our particular tradition. And about, I don't know how many came, 80 to 100 came to Spirit Rock to spend some days together to talk about what we have in common, teaching, communities, the various things that we're involved in. And in the middle of that meeting, there was a... We sit in this big room in a big circle. In the middle of the circle was placed a scroll. And that scroll was unrolled, and it was really long. And it had something like 1,500 to 2,000 names on it. And it was a kind of a petition or a letter of request to these Buddhist teachers to get engaged in the environmental issues of our time, to provide, actually said, provide some leadership in this area. And so some of the those teachers kind of banded together and have been working on climate change initiatives and things since then. But one of the outcomes of that meeting was the idea that as a collective of teachers and communities, insight communities around the globe, we would take the first week of October and celebrate Earth Care Week. And with the idea that if we work together, the collective action is more meaningful than if we just work as individually. And so this last year and this year, the first week of October has been dedicated to this. And this year, the beginning of the week is yesterday, October 5th. And one of the nice things that's happening is that something like 15 prominent teachers in our tradition are putting on an online, I guess, conference or something on the environment. Started yesterday, and you can go listen to their talks on the environmental issues in Buddhism. And that can be found at a website called One Earth Sangha. So it's kind of nice. And Jack Kornfield and Tara Brock and all kinds of people are addressing this issue. So I wanted to devote today, in honor of Earth Care Week, to talk a little bit about Buddhism and the environment. I think it's it happens frequent enough that people will come to me as a Buddhist teacher or to other Buddhist teachers and expect Buddhist teachers to have all responses to all kinds of things. I mean, you'd be surprised at what people think I have expertise in. Once you're in this role, you're considered a jack of all trades. So a lot of things, and maybe because Buddhism is a religion, there's an expectation that religion is involved in issues of ultimate concern, issues of existential issues of who we are in this universe, what's the meaning of life, how do we live our life, how do we respond to the kind of global kinds of issues, as opposed to Buddhism being just a meditation technology for individuals to sit and meditate and, you know, do their own thing. And so people come and say, well, what does Buddhism have to say about the environment? And how do we respond to the environment? So one of the interesting phenomena in the modern era is people are trying to put together a Buddhist environmental ethic, which never really existed in Buddhism and probably in other religions as well, because 2,500 years ago, this level of environmental concerns that we have today were not so present. And so people have gone back to the early teachings and teaching of Buddhism and picked out things, little things here and there that addressed or can be applied to environmental issues to come up with a global kind of environmental ethic for Buddhism. And I think it's an important thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's a creative thing. It's a lot of creative minds are going in to kind of try and understand Buddhist principles and how it would apply to this kind of thing. And so we're all part of this, kind of coming up with kind of a new form of Buddhism, or at least the aspect of Buddhism, Buddhist teachings. So in having this Earth Care Week, one of the wonderful words is the word care. And I like the word care. In my mind, it's another way of saying compassion, but it means compassion with action. You can care, but somehow in my mind, at least, my vocabulary, that caring is one step. Compassion means you have empathy and sympathy and concern. But care has a double meaning, that you care about something, but you actually have cared about it. You actually done something. You care for someone who's sick. And so it's a beautiful thing to be compassionate. It's a beautiful thing to care. As I often like to point out, they say that pure compassion or clean compassion that doesn't come with distress, produces oxytocin. And oxytocin is this wonderful chemical that makes us feel good. And maybe this is why the Dalai Lama says over and over again that if you want to be happy, care for others. If you want to be happy, be concerned with the welfare of others. And I remember very well, still to this day, the time that I was caring for someone. It was ongoing. It went on through the day. And it was intermittent. And I found that every time I took care of her, I felt so good. I just like felt warm and a little bit tingly and felt like kind of whole and connected and, wow, this is interesting. And then we part a little bit and then we come together and I would care for her again. And, ooh, this feels good. And compassion can be, you know, can be a wonderful thing. It can be very nurturing and meaningful for the person who's compassionate. And it's a beautiful thing that your compassion and care, supposedly if it's done well, supports and nourishes, helps someone else, serves someone else. And isn't it nice that it can serve both people? So the environment. We have this, and we only have one planet. And this planet has done an amazing job in, managing to first evolve us and then manage to support us for a long time. Humans have been around for a while. I don't know exactly how many, hundreds of thousands of years, but been around for a while. And but there's more and more of us. And the more and more of us has become an issue. I read recently that human beings in the last 40 years have been used more natural resources than the previous 4,000 years of human history. Isn't that something? What a ratio. Boy, really, we lucked out. We were the ones that got, the bank vaults open, and we got to go in and grab everything. And aren't we lucky to be so rich? Maybe. But that's quite something that, compared to all of human history, how much we consume. And that huge consumption, if it's going to go up and up and up, has big impacts on the world. And I don't know if you know this, but we have this wonderful San Francisco Bay, and especially the south end of the bay here, the water is fairly shallow. And the naturalist, ecologists, whoever the people take care of the bay, they've made a decision that they don't want to stir the mud. They don't want to do anything that upsets. They don't want to dig it up in any kind of way down here. Because underneath, just not so far down underneath the layers of the mud, there's a huge layer of arsenic. And that arsenic is there because, is it arsenic or cyanide? I suppose it's arsenic. When they, the part of the treasure vault that opened up for us here in California was all this minerals and gold and silver up in the Sierras and also down a little bit down south and near San Jose. And one of the ways that they did a fantastic job moving mountains. They just kind of like destroyed 130 years ago, 40 years, they were destroying mountains up in the Sierras. They had water guns, and they bump water, and they tore up mountains, and they used this, I guess, this arsenic to kind of separate out the gold from the soil, from the mud, or whatever it was. And all this deluge of water with all this arsenic had to go somewhere. And so it ended up in the San Francisco Bay. And it settled in the bottom of the bay. And yes, please, you know it better?
Mercury.
Oh, it's mercury.
Quicksilver.
Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I shouldn't be talking about this. So mercury. And so now it's laying there, and they don't want to stir up the bay because it's better. It's right now it's safe under the layers of mud. Well, wow, that's something. So that's been repeated over and over again in many places in the world where human creativity has managed to open up the treasure vaults of this earth and have created a lot of damage in the process of using all this stuff up and put a tremendous amount of poisonous metals into the ground, all kinds of things go in all kinds of places. So here's an interesting thing that I don't know how, maybe this gentleman knows more than I do. I'd love to be told more. But there's what they've been learning in recent times, I don't know how prevalent it is, but there's a wonderful technique for cleaning up soils that have been polluted with toxins of various kinds. And this is called phytoremediation. And phytoremediation, phyto means plant, is using plants to somehow heal that those poison polluted soils. And there's different plants that do different things. And there's some plants that will actually absorb the poisons in the soil and the toxins, and then you can harvest the plant and then do something more responsible or careful with all the toxins the plant has taken up. Sunflower is apparently very good for arsenic. So it takes a while. You have to do it many times and harvest and all that. But that can clean it out rather than digging up the soil and doing some mechanical, chemical process to clean it up. And then there's a process called phytotransformation. This one I love. The transformation by plants. So organic poisons, like pesticides, like that, they end up in concentrated forms in the soil, oils and different organic things. And there are certain plants that if you grow those plants, they'll absorb those organic compounds and transform them into something that's safe. They'll digest them or something like that. Isn't that great? So in our wonderful natural world, there are, at least sometimes, built into the natural system solutions that the plant world provides. And what a gift. What an amazing thing. And so someone found these plants, found these different things, and they all have these, some of them have these amazing uses, as we know. I don't know what the number is, but do you know how many plants are on the verge of being extinct? What if one of the ones that are just about to go extinct, or does go extinct today, tomorrow they look back and we needed that plant. That's the plant that can take the smog out of the air. That's the plant that can do something. But, we let it merrily go and disappear. We don't know how much we need the natural world. Our life is completely intertwined and built into it, this beautiful mutuality. And maybe we need all of it to really kind of live harmonious in a cooperative life. Here's a quote by a great Thai Buddhist teacher named Buddhadasa. He wrote, "The entire cosmos is a cooperative. The sun, the moon, and the stars live together as a cooperative. The same is true for humans and animals, trees, and the earth. Our bodily parts function as a cooperative. When we realize that the world is a mutual, interdependent, cooperative enterprise, that human beings are all mutual friends in the process of birth, old age, suffering, and death, Then we can build a noble, even a heavenly environment. If our lives are not based on this truth, then we'll all perish. So it's a cooperative, so we better cooperate. And maybe we need everything in order to make it all work. So to care for this world is a way of caring for ourselves. So in terms of looking at Buddhism for some environmental clues for an environmental ethic, there's a great, what's called a fable called Jataka tale, that's similar to other cultures have similar ones like this, of poor farmers, poor destitute farmers who were just barely getting by. And somehow or other they ended up with a golden swan. All the feathers were golden. And they found that they plucked one feather, they'd have all this, you know, it was worth a lot, they can go sell the feather and have money, food and money to last for a while. And so then one of the farmers, when everyone else was away, one day got kind of greedy, because, you know, one feather is good, but the whole swan full of feathers is even better. So that person plucked all the flowers out of the swan. Not the flowers, all the feathers. And when they came back and found the swan was still alive but had no feathers, they wondered, what's going to happen now? What happened was that ordinary feathers grew back. And that was it for the golden feathers. So who knows, when we harvest too much, take too much out of this natural world, then at some point our beautiful swan, globe, whatever, is not going to keep producing enough in order to take care of us. I grew up in half my growing up was on the Mediterranean coast. And I spent a fair amount of time in some of these islands in the coast of Yugoslavia. And beautiful, beautiful islands. However, part of why they're beautiful is where they're beautiful for their starkness of just being all these rocks and denuded rocks. And just like, you know, Half Dome is beautiful, right? Maybe. And 2,000 years ago, the Romans wanted trees and whatever else that islands had. And the trees, and some of these islands were denuded. And that soil then washed away. And once the soil washed away, nothing could grow back because of the soil. And so that's an example of taking all the feathers off the golden swan. And then the golden swan can't produce any more. So we're coming to this now in many ways in our globe. It's happened over and over again for not just in the modern world, but back that was 2,000 years ago with the Romans. In many places in the world where humans have overused, over-extracted, over-whatever, and destroyed the environment so it couldn't support life anymore. Now it may be happening more on a global level. And there's, you know, already we're seeing lots and lots of suffering in the world. One of the very sad things about the environmental suffering is that it's the people who consume the least who experience the consequences of those who consume the most. That it's the wealthy who have the most highest levels of consumption, and sometimes it's the people who support that consumption in a variety of different ways, with mining and harvesting and forest, you know, denuding of forests and stuff. It happens where the indigenous people live, with people who are in third world countries, and they suffer in terrible ways that people in California don't see the consequences of what their consumption are. So are we supposed to get distressed by this? Are we supposed to now feel guilty and terrible by it? That's one option, but that's not the compassionate option. Compassion has nothing to do with distress. Caring is supposed to be something that is nourishing and meaningful for everyone. Compassion only makes sense, only occurs, if there is suffering. So there is a kind of bittersweet thing about compassion. But part of what compassion is a hopefully a kind of welcoming response to the conditions of the world, where something more than the world gets healed or someone else gets healed, but we get healed. From a Buddhist point of view, the ecological crisis is a psychological crisis. And Buddhist environmental ethic pulls upon ancient Buddhist teachings that, you know, I think back 2,500 years ago, maybe it was more, mythic than it was than it would be valid today, that the state of the earth, the state of our natural world, the health of it is directly in relationship to the ethics, the ethical behavior and activities, minds of human beings. As people get more greedy, the world gets worse. As people get more hostile, the natural world decreases. As people live more deluded, the natural world, health of the natural world decreases. And that's kind of what we see all around the world right now. Places of war, places of hostility, tremendous amount of environmental damage is occurring. How many oil fields in Iraq have been destroyed in the last 25 years? It seems to happen regularly now in Syria. That and the bombing of oil fields, the explosion of them, the burning of them. And the people who live nearby are suffering from the toxic effects of some of these oil fields that have been bombed and burned and all that. The result of hostility. Greed, you know, the mercury in the San Francisco Bay is a result of greed, of people who wanted silver or gold at all expenses, and delusion, not understanding all this. So for Buddhism, it's a psychological crisis as much as an ecological one. So back to plants, beautiful plants that can be an example for us. Some plants have a kind of a membrane between, I don't know exactly where it is, but between the flower and the stem, or between the fruit and the stem, somewhere in there, where the plant will take in sometimes toxins from the soil, but the toxins won't pass through that membrane. So the fruit that grows in that plant won't absorb, won't have those, will be free of those things. Lead is one example. Lead will not pass through some of these membranes. So even though there's a lot of lead in the soil, and you don't want to eat the leaves of some plants because of the lead, the fruit can be free of the lead. So this membrane that protects the thing. So one of the important, using that as a metaphor, I think one of the very important tasks in responding to environmental crisis is that we need to be not phyto-transformers, but what do we call the Homo sapien transformers. That there's so much toxin in the world of psychology, in the world of human beings, in terms of greed and hate and fear and all kinds of things, that one of the things that we I think we need to do is learn the ability to take this in, take in the world, have it affect us, and transform it so that the fruit of who we are, our fruit, is not poisoned by what goes around us. And so this is one of the reasons why Buddhist practice is so important, because it's this, Homo sapien transforming machine, that we don't succumb to the greed, we don't succumb to the fear, we don't succumb to the distress, we don't succumb to the hostility that is so contagious and so rampant in this world. But somehow we're able to be mindful of it, be present for it, and transform it so that the fruit of us, how we act and behave in the world and live in the world, expresses something that's free of those toxins. So if we're free of greed, then we can express generosity. If we're free of hate, we can express love. If we're free of delusion, we can have wisdom. If we have free of fear, I don't know, then we'd have courage. And that kind of work goes hand in hand with the work of compassion. Because, as I said, the beautiful aspects of compassion, the way it's nourishing, cannot be nourished if the compassion is mixed up with some of these, if you allow me to use the word, toxins of greed, hate, and delusion. And so, back to the word care, Earth Care Week. I think caring is a beautiful thing. And I like it that this is called Earth Care Week. That somehow, at least for one week a year, we give a little more focus to the nourishment of care, the healing of care, the inspiration of care, the the goodness of care that we're all capable of. And this transformative process, we live in a world of greed, hate, and delusion, and we experience our own distress and fear and numbness and denial and, you know, and overwhelm with it all. But to transform it so it comes out of us in the fruit of caring and caring for others and for the world. This is, I think, one of the great tasks that I hope that people who do Buddhist practice are willing to do. And caring doesn't have to mean, managing to make big changes in the world, but a lot of small changes, you know, I don't know if they're going to be good enough, but they make a difference. And so what can you do that would express care for this natural world, the world that we live in? What are some of the small things, what are the large things that you can do? Yesterday, I gave a talk, something like this, for a Sunday morning, and I asked how many people had walked to IMC, how many people had carpooled, how many people had taken the train, bus, and one person had taken public transportation yesterday. And there were, the most people walked, but it would mean, what was to mean, there were like maybe seven. And everyone else had driven. There were one set of four that had carpooled. Can we do more of that? Can we do more of that? To care for the natural world by how we drive is not just caring for the natural world. For those of us living in the Bay Area, if we can create less smog in the Bay Area, we're also caring for children in the Central Valley. There's a much higher incidence of asthma in the Central Valley because we're so lucky that all this smog we make usually gets blown away into the Central Valley, and they have to live with our smog. So it's caring for the children in the Central Valley to drive less if you can. It's caring for all kinds of things to produce less smog. One of the So to care, and when do we start? When do we start? And when do we start in such a way that it becomes a movement and makes a big change? I remember when, I think it was San Francisco was the first city who banned plastic bags. Is that right? The first one, California at least. And what? San Jose was first? Really? That's nice. And I think that some of the people I talked to were kind of like surprised, and I thought it was San Francisco, and they said, oh, it's the hippies in San Francisco. And the people, many people were kind of dismissive of San Francisco doing it. And now it's a state law. You know, it's grown from there. Or when I was growing up in Los Angeles in the late 60s, they had an election where they ask people to vote whether they'd be willing to separate out the trash between the trash and the recycling. And overwhelmingly, people in LA at that time voted no. It's a drag, it's a burden, you know, it's a troublesome thing to do to separate out, you know, it's all this extra work. And now we don't think about it, it's obvious that's what we do. In fact, now they don't let us vote on it, they just bring us the bins and say, you have to do it this way. Things change. And small changes build up momentum. And hopefully they change with someone, they change with you. And how they change can be your fruit. The fruit, how the Homo sapien transformers that we are. How we take the toxins, the psychotoxins that exist in our world and let them come through us in such a way that we then, the fruit of the purified fruit, the fruit that doesn't have any of those toxins, is our care for others and for the world around us, I think is a great thing. I think it's hopeless. I believe it's kind of hopeless to think about making a difference for the environment and making a big change unless we enjoy the process. Unless we feel it nourishing and meaningful so that we want to do it, not out of a sense of duty and sense of obligation and like, oh, one more thing to do, but rather we find that it our life gets benefited as a result. So this is maybe a small, silly example, but as often as I can, I walk to IMC or bike to IMC. And I like to do it because I don't want to drive a car that makes more smog in the area. So that's kind of one of the main reasons I do it. But I love walking. It's like one of my, not a highlight, but it's one of the great periods of my day. When I walk here, I like walking down here and looking at the trees and the sky and getting the exercise and feeling the air, whatever. And I come down here, I feel more alive and energized in a very nice way than I do if I drove down here. And so, you know, I would do it even if I could, even if, you know, they suddenly discovered that smog is actually good. So how can we demonstrate to the world in our caring for all this? Not that we do it because we need to, we have to, but we do it because in a way that we benefit from it, that our life is enhanced and improved by it. What does it take to have our life enhanced and improved? One of the things it takes is to learn how maybe consuming less, learn how to consume less, how to use less in a way that enhances our life. What do we want to do with the resources we have, with the time we have, with the money we have that we didn't spend consuming things maybe that we don't need? So, I'm so glad I didn't buy that. I'm so glad because I was able to donate money to this great cause. Or I was so glad I didn't buy that thing because I would have had to spend an hour or two driving around, checking out the prices, what I did instead was I stayed and gardened in my garden, or I hung out with a neighbor and we hadn't talked for a few months. It was great to just hang out. And that felt really good. So I don't know if my examples are so good, but I think the principle I'm trying to get across is that I would hope that this Homo sapien transformation machine that we can be can take what's going on, the great challenge that exists in our world, many of the challenges we have, and somehow as understanding of it, as knowledges of it, as the psychological crisis of it all, as we become aware of it, that we respond to it all by in some ways taking it in, transforming in such a way that the fruit is protected by the membrane of our practice. And the fruit that we can offer back in the world is caring for the world, caring for others, in a way that is inspiring, that's rejuvenating, that makes us happy, makes us feel content, makes us feel, of course I do this. This is not a burden to do this. This is, I feel better because of this. As the Dalai Lama said, if you want to be happy, care for others. Care for the world. So that's my attempt at environmental ethic for you. And so we have this week until Sunday to be Earth Care Week. So I think it would be quite inspiring, especially to me, but it's hopefully to all of us, if all of us this week could give some thought to what I've said today and consider how you can do something that would be an expression of caring for this world, caring for the earth, and to do it in a way that nourishes you. Not so it's kind of a drag of a sacrifice, but you do it, you look, you try to, you consider and think about how can I do this in a way that I'm a better person from it, that I'm happier because of doing it. And then you might want to do it again. And then there's hope for us, I think. And then hopefully it's contagious. Your neighbors will see how happy you are. So we have 5 minutes, and this is a huge topic and so important for our society as a whole, for this globe as a whole. I didn't leave you enough time to say a lot, but do anybody want to comment about that or have any questions about what I said? Please.
Is this on? Yeah. So one thing I started doing years ago is I started hanging up the laundry and not using the dryer. And it started out as this thing of, oh, I have to do this because, you know, the dryer uses so much electricity and blah, blah, blah. And it has become the highlight of my day because I'm outside with the birds and I'm looking at everything. And it's just such a lovely experience that I make time for pretty much every day to hang the laundry up on the line. And it has just given me so much joy.
Mm. Yeah. The times I've done that, I delight because my clothes smell fresher. It's like a luxury. Wow. Yes. Is there a light on?
No. Okay. I just didn't push it enough. So I'm trying to understand something. Buddhist compassion is the same now as it was 100 years ago, but 100 years ago, maybe a Buddhist would not have been so conscious of the environment and may have had different choices about a lot of things, moral issues and all of that. What's going on there?
No, I understand. So I would say that in the past there was a Buddhist ethic, morality, how to live compassionately and caring for this world, and it was applied to the issues of their time. So that's true. And the scale of environmental issues that Buddhists had to face in Asia maybe were not as great as what we have today. If you go back in Christianity more than 100 years ago, how much of an environmental ethic do we find in Christianity? Probably don't find that much. You know, and just like not any more or less than probably you find in other religions. So maybe I don't understand the question.
I think maybe I don't understand either. I don't understand where my confusion comes from.
But I don't know either, but I will give you an answer anyway. You see in early Buddhism a care for the natural world. And one of the places you see it is in the only people that the Buddha felt that he could really give strong guidance to how he's supposed to live his life, their lives, were his monastic followers, because they had really committed to that kind of life. And my impression was that the Buddha was more circumspect about telling lay people what they should be doing. But the people he could tell what to do, he gave them a very strong teachings on nonviolence. You don't kill animals, and you don't destroy plant life, and you don't dig in the ground because you might destroy the worms, the animals in there. So a very strong care of not causing harm to the natural world was very important back then. And so that was expressed there. And then being very careful with natural resources seems to have been built into also that monastic life. And so there's a story of someone comes to, I think it's Ananda, Buddha's disciple. I guess maybe a story, something like someone gave him a new set of robes. But he had a set of robes already. So someone said, what are you doing with a new set of robes when you have a set of robes? You should keep it, you know, not have more, use more resources. And he said, well, what happens when I get a new set of robes, and my old robes still have, I turn them into a bedspread. But what do you do when the bedspread gets old? Well, then I make it into a mattress cover. And what happens when the mattress cover gets old? Well, then I turn it into a towel. And what happens when the towel gets old? Well, then I turn it into a rug, you know, floor covering. And what do you do when the floor covering gets all old? Said, well, then I cut it up into pieces and I pack it into the mud that we use to build the walls of the huts. So this, you know, so rather than throwing anything away, you keep reusing it and being careful and with the resources. So those are the kind of stories that people try to find environmental ethic in Buddhism, want to find, you know, the justification or inspiration from the early tradition, will call on those stories or those examples that, yes, it's there as well. So that's, you know, is good enough for an answer? Great, thank you. Okay, so Earth Care Week. Think about it this week, please.